Aloha Shalom. Shoshim, I guess, technically passed a couple minutes ago, but we'll still be commemorating Shoshim right now. I want to, of course, thank Aliana for coming, but also my parents for being here, and wish Nechama to my father after 30 days of the passing of his mother. And I want to acknowledge also my grandmother's mechutenis, Trudy Balk, who lives in Kew Gardens Hills, who was able to join us tonight. It was a very nice surprise. Just to share a few words about my grandmother before we go into the shiur, and I think that the topic for the shiur tonight will very much speak to who she was. My grandmother and my grandfather were both traditional Jews, not fully observant Jews per se, but my grandmother grew up in a kosher home, and she made a kosher home. My dad describes how on Friday nights they never went out and left the kids at home, but there was always Shabbos dinner. They always went to shul on Shabbos. My grandmother ran a gift shop before there was Amazon. If you wanted to buy Judaica, you went to the synagogue gift shop. So I remember when I was young, she was still always running the gift shop in her shul. She was a very education-oriented person. She did not go to college. I actually didn't know this until after she was in Yitera, but she originally did not go to college when she was in her late teens. She only went back to college when my aunt, who's 12 years younger than my father, went to college. So she went to school at that point, got a bachelor's and a master's in social work. I remember when I was younger, she wanted to learn Hebrew. And for me, as a 6 or 7 year old, learning Hebrew was very easy. For somebody her age, it was not as easy. And I couldn't fully appreciate that. But I now see how heroic it was that she continued to learn Hebrew. She went when she was in Cedar Village in Cincinnati, where she lived until she passed away. She went to all the classes of all the rabbis there. Was a very loyal student, as my aunt put it. I mentioned that she was a social worker. As much as she was a very interesting person, and I always enjoyed listening to what she had to say, she was very interested in other people. She listened to everybody's stories in Cedar Village. I love talking on phone with her because we just would have great conversations, and spending time together as a family was always something that I really valued, even though we never lived near her. So I guess just to conclude these very brief words of eulogy, my sister-in-law Lisa, who was not able to be here tonight, she said to me the other day that Bubby would have loved to come to this class. So I hope that what we discuss tonight will be of aliyah for her neshama. So in this vein, I mentioned that she was passionate about Judaism, passionate about psychology and social work, and I guess the last thing I actually forgot to mention was that she, despite having been born in America, did not go through the Holocaust. She was very fascinated by Holocaust history, and she always talked about it. So I thought, you know, what better way to combine all those interests than to talk about Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. It's a book I bought a few years ago at the YU's farm sale. I had started it, never finished it, but I decided to pick it up, and I really think that the ideas there will bring together her passions. But despite having been written primarily as a work of psychology and not necessarily, and his what he did in his therapy was not necessarily Jewish per se, I think there's a lot of Jewish ideas we can see from it. So Viktor Frankl was a survivor of the Holocaust, and he was a psychiatrist born in Vienna, and I believe he died in Vienna also. And his passion in life was a theory of psychology, a theory of therapy that he called logotherapy. If you look on the first page, really page two, so logos is a Greek word which denotes meaning. Therefore, logotherapy focuses on the meaning of human existence, on man's search for such a meaning. According to logotherapy, the striving to find a meaning in one's life is a primary motivational force in man. And if you have to sum up everything that Viktor Frankl wrote and what we're speaking about tonight, it's this, is that the primary goal in life is to look for meaning. So the truth is, he started this whole thing of logotherapy, he really started before he went through the Holocaust, and he came into Auschwitz with manuscripts that he wanted to publish, which of course were taken away from him. But what ended up happening was that coming out of the Holocaust, he found that his theories were entirely confirmed by his experience and the experience of others that he was with in the Holocaust. And he wrote Man's Search for Meaning in about, over the course of 9 days, about a year after the Holocaust or something like that. So it's a very interesting thing. So as I mentioned, logotherapy that he developed was about finding meaning. And this was in distinction from Freud, who believed that a person's drive in life was for pleasure, or Adler, who believed that a person was motivated by power. Frankl believed that we're motivated by meaning. This is last week, for those of us who were at the Pirkei Avos here, I spoke about Ezu Chacham and Ezu Ashir, Ezu Gibor, who is wise, who is a hero, who is wealthy. And in essence, you know, if you take those things that the Mishnah says, talks about, you know, being heroic or being wealthy, so if you look at them in the most literal sense, so that's Freud and Adler, who believe that, you know, it's about pleasure or power or whatnot. And the Mishnah says, no, it's actually really about something much larger than that. And that's where Frankl comes in and says that even, you know, basic needs in some ways are not really enough, but to be truly happy, for example, to be truly wealthy is really to be happy, to find, in other words, to find meaning in life. Okay? Of course, his theories were not widely accepted at first. Rabbi Reuven Bolka, who is a rabbi in Canada, and he wrote his doctorate on logotherapy. So he writes that that when Frankl would go to speak in places like Hebrew University and places in Israel, so Jews had an affinity for Freud in earlier days, so people always dismissed Frankl. So his ideas weren't widely accepted. But here we are. His book has sold millions and millions of copies. So this one book that I'm, of course, picking from is only one of his books, which really focuses on the Holocaust. He, of course, wrote a whole other myriad of books on logotherapy. I'm not going to focus on those, but going to focus on his experience in the Holocaust. So as I mentioned, his experience in the Holocaust corroborated this idea that people are searching for meaning in life. And the book is really divided into two parts. One is really talking about his experience in the Holocaust, and the second part, which he added later, he talks a little bit more about logotherapy now that you've sort of seen the experience, so he kind of summarizes it. But in that first part where he talks about the Holocaust, there's really three phases that he describes in going through the Holocaust. One is getting to the camps and the initial shock that one felt, seeing what was happening, everything being taken away from them, and you know that of course for anybody that would be extremely shocking. The loss of his manuscript was a part of that shock, that he was hoping to be able to hold on to it, and the fact that he had to let go of his life's work was very challenging. And part of that shock was also, on the other hand, what he called the illusion of reprieve, meaning that he thought that, well, there are many people who thought, well, maybe it's not going to be as bad as we think it is, or what we heard it is. And then they see how bad it actually is, and that shock sort of sinks in. The part that he focuses on the most, really, is the long-term life in the camps. And what he describes psychologically is going on there is apathy, a total lack of emotion. And he says that sort of an abnormal reaction to an abnormal situation is normal in some ways. So the lack of emotion and the, you know, witnessing, the gas chamber is witnessing people being beaten at a certain point loses its shock value because it became so ingrained in what was happening there that really all they cared about was survival, and apathy was what guided them through that situation. And that apathy was sort of furthered by hunger and lack of sleep and irritability. So he describes situations where, for example, when a particular person died of typhus, so people started going through and taking this person's socks and whatever food they have left over, and you would think that, you know, that's crazy. How could someone just die and how could you do that? But that was the apathy that sort of sank in. And essentially what the mission of a person going through this was, in order to survive, was really, in some ways, to overcome the apathy. Because once apathy sank in, so that was sort of resignation to one's fate and the lack of, you know, the pessimism that one would actually get out of the camps. So what he describes in terms of the mission of surviving Auschwitz was not really, it wasn't so much about how much power, you know, how strong somebody was think I wrote about that somewhere. It wasn't how strong somebody was or how, you know, how clever they were to, but it was really just about being able to overcome that apathy and find some sort of meaning, both in the suffering and something to look forward to, something meaningful to look forward to that would keep one alive. So he describes moments of spirituality in the camp. He would think about, he said that when he thought about his wife sometimes and the thought of reuniting with her, which he did not, but his hopes to reunite with her kept him going. Sometimes, you know, art, looking at sunsets, satire, and humor would guide people through would guide people through the camp. So in essence, it was, you know, both feeling like there was meaning in what was happening, but also something to look forward to. And he described situations where that both worked and didn't work. So example where it didn't work was he talks about a particular person in the camp who was, you know, he had a dream that the camps were going to be liberated. This was like February 1945. He had a dream that the camps were going to be liberated in March 1945, and he really believed it, so he kept going. Then when March 31st came along, the camps had been liberated, he passed away a couple of days later. So that to him was an example that sort of corroborated that lack of anything to hold on to led people to let go. Or he said that there were more deaths around the time of Christmas and New Year's and other times because they had the sense that, well, maybe during this particular time period, you know, something will happen, you know, people will be able to go home to their families, and when that didn't happen, people sort of lost their hope. But on the other hand, he notes that there was one time where he had to do collective psychotherapy. There was a particularly bad day in the camp where there was collective punishment, and, you know, one of the leaders, the prisoners, spoke a little bit about optimism and turned it to Frankl, the psychiatrist. And Frankl, not himself really being in a great mood, still sort of tried to guide people through insights to give, talked about the importance of meaning, and people found that to be very helpful. So, in essence, what he found in the camps was that the people who were able to find both meaning in what was happening at the moment, or find things to look forward to, those were the people who were able to survive the most. And his own personal moment of meaning, actually, I have this in source two, and at this point we'll really go mostly into the sources. His own religious moment of meaning, he says, when, you know, he got a new coat when he came into the camp instead of his old coat, where the manuscripts. He said he found a torn page of a Hebrew prayer book which contained the Shema. So how should I have interpreted such a coincidence, quote unquote, other than as a challenge to live through my thoughts instead of merely putting them on paper? So, you know, so he himself obviously wasn't, you know, just because he believed in theory doesn't mean that it was easy for him, but having those moments for him really got him through. So he describes, of course, his theory of logotherapy. He describes his experiences in the camp, but does Judaism have anything to do with any of this? So Rabbi Volkow, who I mentioned before, says that, you know, you can't necessarily equate logotherapy with Judaism because within the values that Frankl discusses, so Judaism might have a plurality of opinions on various things. I'm going to mostly, you know, present the ways that they do jive, but they might not necessarily always. But also, when Frankl wrote his works and when he engaged as a therapist himself, so he obviously had to cater to a broader audience. So his goal was not necessarily to, you know, so in theory he might have been able to tie everything together with Judaism, and he was kind of criticized for not really making it a more Jewish idea, but at the same time he was trying to give it a little bit of a broader appeal. But let's look at some of the foundations of logotherapy, and we'll see how they played out in the camps as well. So first, he notes that the foundation of everything is that you have to believe in free will in order for anything meaningful to work. This is the beginning on page 2 in source 3. So Rabbi Volkow writes that, you know, without free will, life loses its meaning, so that meaningfulness and faith in the same are predicated on free will. So in order to have any sort of meaning, you have to believe in free will because you have to create that meaning for yourself. So meaning doesn't just come to you, but you have to be willing to create it. So in a certain sense, you have to believe in free will. In source 4, I think this is a very powerful quote, so you might think that if you were in the camp, you're put in this situation, so everything's kind of determined for you. And in many ways, almost everything was. Your conditions and literally your life and death were determined by other people. Your entire dignity was sealed, and you might get into forming ideas of, you know, drives for pleasure and power and how that guided people, you know, every man for himself. But Frankl says no. The experiences of camp life show that man does have a choice of action. We who lived in concentration camps can remember the men who walked through the huts comforting others, giving away their last piece of bread. They may have been few in number, but they offer sufficient proof that everything can be taken from a man but one thing. The last of human freedoms to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way. And there are always choices to make. Describes every moment, every hour, there are always choices to make. So going through the camp itself, so if you resign to yourself that I really don't have any choices here, there's nothing I can really do, so, you know, that was one attitude. But he believed that really to make it through the camps, one first had to believe that there was one thing that Nazis couldn't take away, and that was one's free will, one's ability to choose life and in turn to choose meaning. And this idea, of course, is a very Jewish idea. We believe in free will as Jews. And I'll show a couple of ideas here that I think really bring out this point well. One of Gemara and Brachos, it says, HaKol bidei shamayim chutz miyira shamayim, a famous Gemara, that everything is in the hands of heaven except for yira shamayim, except for fear of heaven. And Rashi explains that, you know, it's true that, for the most part, we are very much created the way we are through our genetic makeup, through our environment, our intelligence, our skin color. Everything is really, everything is in the hands of heaven. About tzaddik v'rasha eino ba'al yedei shamayim. But whether we choose to be righteous or wicked does not come from heaven. You can be put in any situation and still have the basic ability to choose to do a good thing or a bad thing. And Gemara and Tubot has a slightly different formulation of it. It says, HaKol bidei shamayim chutz bitzinim v'pachim. All matters are in the hands of heaven except for cold and heat, meaning that, you know, if it's cold out, okay, so it's cold outside, so you might think, well, there's nothing I can do about that, so put a coat on. So Rashi explains everything being in the hands of heaven, bidei shamayim im ba'im porniyot ala adam gzeret ha-melechu. This is a holocaust, that suffering comes from heaven, but we still have, you know, you can be put in that situation, and nonetheless, we still have the ability to choose how we navigate that situation. And Tosfos explains here that what we said in Brachos, and what Rashi explained about, about all the things that are determined for us, so those are things determined in the womb, our genetic makeup, the families we're born through, that's all really predetermined in some ways. But when it comes to events in a person's life, so that is not predetermined. The way we respond to events in our lives is in our hands. And that is fundamentally what Frankl believed, is that the poor aniyot that people went through the Holocaust was not in their hands. That was bidei shamayim. But people's ability to choose and how they wanted to navigate that situation was in their hands. I can't talk about free will, of course, without quoting the Rambam. Granted that the Rambam has a, you know, possibly a slightly different view in the Mishnah Torah than he does in the Morah Nebuchim, but I'll stick with the Mishnah Torah. And in Hilchos Truvah, he talks about how a person has the ability to choose to be a tzaddik or a rasha, and that's something that separates human beings from other animals. And if somebody tells you that, you know, that everything is predetermined at birth, they're wrong. You can be Moshe Rabbeinu, or you can be Yeravam, you could be who's the worst king of Israel. Everything is really in your hands in that sense. So, you know, I just wanted to quote that to amplify that point of free will. And just to hammer the point home that I thought was also relevant, I think, for this context. So there's a pasuk towards the end of Dvarim in Parshas Nitzavim that says, "V'charta b'chaim l'man tichya tav zarecha." You should choose life in order that you and your offspring will live. Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch has a very beautiful comment here. He says that, you know, you don't just, yeah, we obviously all have life on some level, but to coast through life and you know, just to let it go as if it's sort of accidental. So that's not really life. You have to choose to want to live life. Okay, and again, obviously on a basic level, it doesn't necessarily work on that level, but I think what he's trying to say is that if you want to have meaning in your life, then you really have to actively choose that. And that's Sprinkle's point, is that if we want to experience life in its fullest, and we want to whether it's to navigate a situation or whether just to feel like our life is something of importance, so you have to will that. You have to believe that that's your choice to live that way. Any questions or comments up till now? Okay. We'll keep going. Okay, so foundation number one for Frankl and logotherapy and his experience in the Holocaust was that people have the willing to choose. I'm going, perhaps a little bit out of order in terms of the best way to do this, but given that we've been framing this in terms of the Holocaust, so I want to talk about his points about meaning and suffering, because that was a big foundation of his, is that we find meaning in suffering. Because his point will be is that if you accept that there is anything as meaning in life, which hopefully we can, then there must be meaning in suffering, because suffering is an ineradicable part of life, even as fate and death. So one of his foundations is that at the end of the day, if you want to find meaning in life, so you have to accept life in all its facets, and unfortunately, that includes suffering, and he experienced that. But even in suffering, he believes he could find meaning. And how do we do that? He says we must never forget that we may also find meaning in life. This is in source 11. We may also find meaning in life when confronted with a hopeless situation, when facing a challenge that cannot be changed, when we are no longer able to change a situation. Just think of an incurable disease. We are challenged to change ourselves. We're challenged to change ourselves. That's the meaning that one can find in suffering. That when we're in a situation, it's a time that we can introspect and think about what makes our lives worth living and what do I want to do to make my life even more worth living as I go through this. And this, I think, very much dovetails very well with a major speech of Rav Soloveitchik, Kodo Dido Fake. And I'm curious if the Rav was influenced by Frankl at all, because a lot of what he describes here is very similar. So the Rav gave this speech, Kodo Dido Fake. It's like most of my drashos are about 2 to 4 pages, single space, 12 font. This speech is like 10 pages like that. So it was a very, very long speech, or 20, actually. I think it was much longer than that. But he gave this on Yom HaTzmaut in 1958. Kodo Dido Fake, My Beloved Is Knocking. The speech is mostly famous for the six knocks that Hashem was beckoning people to recognize and come to the State of Israel. But before he gets there, he talks about suffering and the Holocaust. And he notes that, one of the deepest mysteries of Judaism is a problem of suffering. Why is it that good people suffer? Why does suffering exist? And he makes a distinction between two different ways of being. There's fate and there's destiny. Fate is, in our terms, would be being, God forbid, throwing in the concentration camps where you're acted upon, you're passive, it's what comes to you in life, it's not anything you choose. And at that stage, people will ask the question, why does suffering happen? Right? If you believe that it just sort of, if you stay in that stage of, the suffering comes and nothing to do, why is this here? So that's that particular stage. But he says that what man's mission is, what a person's mission is to really move to an existence of destiny. Destiny is active with an understanding of uniqueness and value, freedom and capacity. So he says, right, you might be born and die against your will, okay, which is in some ways being put on this earth is in some ways a fate, and nonetheless, it is within its capacity to live as a subject. According to Judaism, man's mission in this world is to turn fate into destiny. So in that case, once you understand that whatever situation, whatever fate you have, is meant to be turning to destiny. So the question no longer is simply, why does this happen? But what does suffering obligate man to do? And he says, in general, the purpose of suffering is to repair the imperfection of man's persona. So the Rav believed that the questions of theodicy of why do bad things happen to good people is not a question worth, and I think he discusses more in Out of the Whirlwind, another one of his works, but the essence here is not really to discuss why bad things happen to good people as much as it is what can I do with my situation right now. And he notes here that, of course, this is a very current, at the time, a very current thing coming, 13 years out of the Holocaust. So both Frankl and the Rav believe that there is meaning to be found in suffering, and that and suffering is supposed to inspire change. It's meant to inspire us to think of how to make our existence more meaningful. But I think it is important to note that at the same time, Frankl notes source 13 on top of page 5, let me make it perfectly clear that in no way is suffering necessary to find meaning. Right? He doesn't believe that a person should suffer in order that they find meaning. He says you would be a masochist if you did that. The point isn't to purposely experience suffering in order to find meaning, but once you're in that situation, how do I find meaning? And in some ways, that's the most you can really do is in that situation that you would rather not be in. So it's making the best of it. So he notes that. So I mentioned some of the ways that they worked through that in the camps. Whether it was for him, it was thinking about his wife, or thinking about he's talked about how if you would imagine himself standing on a lecture podium, giving a lecture on logotherapy, and rewriting his manuscript, so all of that gave him something to look forward to. But he also notes that there were religious and spiritual moments in the sense. And he in fact writes, source 14, that the religious interest of prisoners as soon as it developed was the most sincere imaginable, that for people who had a religious compass during the Holocaust, that he felt that was something that was very helpful for them. And he even says in source 15 that it was possible for spiritual life to deepen there. So as I said, his ideas of meaning and logotherapy was not necessarily meant to be Jewish per se, but nonetheless, it was very much possible to find spiritual values within that. Just one anecdote that I wanted to note, and I originally discovered this when I went to the Auschwitz exhibit at the Museum of Jewish Heritage a few weeks ago with a few people from here. So there was a particular story that stood out to me of this individual named Mendel Landau. He's a Baba Ber Chassid, and he was in the concentration camps, and he saw somebody come into the camps, and he was wearing tzitzis. And he asked the person, can I borrow your tzitzis to make the bracha and daven and the like? So he did. And then he was beaten very harshly. And then after that, he tried to give the tzitzis back to its original owner. But the owner didn't want them because he figured, if that's the price that you pay for wearing them, I'm not going to do this. So Mendel Landau instead kept the tzitzis. And in the audio guide, I remember them describing that this was like, this is what helped him keep going during the rest of the Shoah, was his tzitzis helped him find meaning. He was wearing them when they were liberated, and he kept them till the day he died. And the tzitzis were actually donated to the museum for this purpose. So that's a picture I have here. Those were Mendel Landau's tzitzis that kept him going during the Holocaust. So that was the way he found meaning. Okay, so basically, Frankl's idea of meaning and suffering is that sometimes a person's put in that fate. It's a part of life, but the way to get through that is to find meaning in that situation, or to find a way to look for it. So now I want to pivot away from suffering and just talk about the importance of finding meaning in life. And here I think we also find some very Jewish ideas. So in source 18, first of all, Rabbi Bulka notes that Frankl called it the will to meaning, not the drive to meaning, which, again, is a response to ideas like Freud we're not talking about things that are predetermined, and we're not talking about subconscious things, but really a person actively choosing to find meaning in life. So what does it mean to live a meaningful life? That's really the question that we're getting to here. So he writes, source 18, that one should not search for an abstract meaning of life. Everyone has his own specific vocation or mission in life to carry out on a concrete assignment which demands fulfillment. Therein, he cannot be replaced, nor can his life be repeated. So, in some ways, the disappointment perhaps of this year tonight is that it's going to be very hard for me to really pin out, here are three things that will transform your life and make it meaningful. Although, I guess inherently I'm doing that by using Torah to frame this discussion, but Frankl's idea was that talking about it in an abstract way is not exactly helpful, because every person has to find within their own selves what their talents are, what their passions are, what they can do to make their own lives meaningful. And that way, in that sense, each person is irreplaceable. And that only reminds me of one of my favorite Mishnayot in Shas, which is the Mishnah in Sanhedrin, source 19, the English is on the back, where we're told that l'fichach nivra adam yichidi, a person was created unique, because anybody who destroys a life is as if he's destroyed the whole world. Anybody saves a life as if he saved the whole world. To Frankl, that was almost literal, that since every person has their own contribution and their own fulfillment, their own meaning, so that could be a whole world. Okay? And the Mishnah describes that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not like an artist who creates everything a little bit differently, but when HaKadosh Baruch Hu puts a stamp on each person, actually, the opposite. When a person stamps, so everything, it's just the same stamp on everything. When the Kaddish Baruch Hu puts a stamp on people, so each one comes out very differently. And then the Mishnah concludes, "L'ficha kol achad ve'achad chayv lomar bishvili nivra ha'olam." For my sake was created the world. And I think that goes very well. I think Frankl in some ways enhances what the Mishnah means by explaining that because we all have our own ways of meaning, okay, even beyond, if I want to argue at some point that Torah and Avodas Hashem is itself meaningful, but yeah, we all have slightly different passions and different careers and the like. So if you really take this to its fullest extent, so each person being unique and each person having meaning means that really one person can mean the whole world. And I think this is echoed also very well in a pasuk, Parshat Nitzavim. Tem Nitzavim Hayom Kolchem. You're all standing before God. Rosh Eichem, Shif Eichem, Zikne Eichem, Veshod Eichem, Kol Ish Yisrael. So first Moshe lists the heads, but then he says Tapchem Neshichem Begerecha Asher Bekerecha Mechanecha Mechotev Eitzecha Ashoev Meimecha. Meaning he describes even the woodchopper and the water drawer. Everybody, even if you're not the Navi, and even if you're not the head of a Shevet, even if you're just a simple worker who contributes to the economy, you also have a part in the Torah and a part of the Jewish people and a unique status. So I think it's an important idea to echo, and especially if we talk about meaning within Judaism, that I really believe that the way every person studies Torah, what they can learn from Torah, everybody can come away with something unique, something to contribute. That's something I want to impart to my future students, and I think that's something very important. That every person has to find their connection to Torah in that sense. Another aspect about finding meaning, however, is that Frankl pushes back against notions. You might think that finding meaning means complete freedom and lack of boundaries and the like, but Frankl really doesn't believe in that. He actually says that in some ways finding meaning was getting harder, because he said it used to be that people had traditions that contributed to this behavior. This is in source 21. But now you either have conformism, where everybody does what other people want them to do, or totalitarianism, you do what other people wish you to do. But it's not tradition, but it's something that you know. Being guided through, you know, other forces that are not necessarily meaningful. The other problem that he points out is that he saw increased boredom in the world. He described what he called the Sunday neurosis, where if you're not working, and it's interesting, so I was listening to a recording by Rabbi Mordechai Tochiner, where he talked about logotherapy also. So somebody noted that he specifically said Sunday, not Saturday, which, you know, itself might be, you know, telling. But, you know, if you work 5 days a week, Sunday, what are you going to do? So, you know, in some ways that can bring out, you know, a sense of a lack of meaning and a loss of direction even when you have one day. But certainly he predicted, I guess somewhat ironically, he predicted that with the more automation, there would be more leisure hours, so people wouldn't know what to do with their time. Now with more technology, I think we're even busier in some ways because we just do things faster and we demand more of people, not because we're bored. But he said the pity of it is that men will now know what to do with all their newly acquired free time. And that sort of reminded me of a couple of things. First of all, you know, Frankl will say that any work that you do, you can possibly find meaning in, right? If you're a doctor, so maybe that's your meaning in life. If you're an accountant, so maybe for you, that's meaning in life. Your work can be meaningful, whatever it is. Judaism, the Gemara specifically, you know, has an interesting discussion. We believe in working, but we also have a sort of a glorified conception of work. And what I mean by that is the Gemara says, "Kol Adam la'amal nivra, shenemar ki Adam la'amal yulad." So there's a pasuk in Job that says that man was born for toil. So then Gemara discusses, well, is that physical work? Is that intellectual work or through speaking? And even if I know it's through speaking, so is it Torah or just general conversation? So because the pasuk that says that the words of Torah shall never depart from your mouth, Hevi omer la'amal Torah nivra, that a person was created to toil in Torah. So this is, you know, again, where, you know, Frankl was not necessarily catering to a Jewish audience, so he was not going to sort of push an agenda of studying Torah, but in some ways, what the Gemara is saying here is that we can find meaning in life through learning Torah. And to take it further to Frankl's point, there's a Mishnah Pirkei Avos that talks about the engraving the tablets. Al tikra charus ela cherus. So don't read the pasuk as graven, but freedom. She'en lecha ben chorin ela misha osek b'talmud Torah. It's Sunday and you have absolutely nothing to do, and Frankl will say you're having Sunday neurosis, so he might say, you know, get a hobby of some sort. But Pirkei Avos is saying that really freedom is you want to know what to do with your newly acquired free time? Learn Torah. Because that itself, that's what we were created for, that itself is a meaningful exercise. The idea of creating and finding meaning, I think, is also echoed by the Rav and Halachic Man, and also in the Only Man of Faith, but I didn't bring anything from there. He says that Halachic Man is someone who longs to create, to bring into being something new, something original. So the Rav here is talking about creating in terms of creating Chidushei Torah, of creating innovative understandings of Torah. But I think if you look at Lonely Man of Faith, and if just on our own, we want to broaden it a little bit, we could say that in general, the Rav believed that, you know, there was Adam 1 and Adam 2, that on the one hand, Adam 2 was the spiritual person, but Adam 1 was also a creative person, and we need both of those, as I mentioned last night, because we're partners in creation. So creativity, specifically within Torah, but even in general, is a very important a part of finding meaning. So that's one thing that Frankl didn't believe that free time was necessarily a good in and of itself for finding meaning, but a person has to be active and creative in order to find meaning. There's another element of this that he talks about, and this I love, that he talks about responsibility. He says, man should not ask what the meaning of his life is, which is actually in some ways a chiddush, because so far it sounded like we're asking, what's my meaning in life? Right? But he says, but rather you must recognize that it is he who is asked. In a word, each man is questioned by life. And he can only answer to life by answering for his own self. To life, he can only respond by being responsible. So in some ways, that's why I'm saying that free time itself was not good to Frankl, because it wasn't really about leisure and free time and being, you know, liberated, but it was about finding something meaningful to contribute to the world and being responsible. And I love this quote that he has towards the end of the book, where he says that he recommends that for the Statue of Liberty on the East Coast, that there be a Statue of Responsibility on the West Coast. I thought that was a very clever thing, because the two really go hand in hand. Of course, I think that's a very big meaning of Pesach, which I won't go into now. But this is also, I think, very much echoed in a pasuk from this week's Parsha. What does Hashem ask of you? Kiim layiras Hashem alokecha alechas b'chol drachav olva oso v'avodas Hashem alokecha b'chol v'avchav l'nafshecha. That fearing God and walking this path and loving Him and serving Him is what Hashem asks of you. And this is, you know, again, hopefully it's not burdensome, but that's a responsibility piece of finding on the one hand finding meaning, but on the other hand, that we are responsible, that we're answerable to something. You know, this idea of what he said, that each man is questioned by life, reminded me of the Gemara on Shabbos, where Rava says that when a person dies and they go up to heaven, so they're asked a number of questions. Did you do business honestly? Did you set aside time for learning Torah? Were you engaged in procreation, which the Maharsha says is not whether you personally procreated, but did you help other people? Did you help orphans be able to have a wedding and to be able to engage in that? So, you know, in a sense, that's, you know, that itself is finding meaning. Did you yearn for salvation? So all these things, you know, show about what a person's responsibility is in life, and that's ultimately what we're answerable to. Okay, and finally, this idea, I think, is very well stated by the Maseios Yesharim, the Ramcha, Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato. The very beginning of Maseios Yesharim, he famously says that the foundation of piety and the root of perfect service is to clarify and come to realize what his obligation is in this world. He says that in some ways, the purpose of life is to enjoy Hashem Shekhinah, but that's an olam haba. In this world, we have responsibilities. I think that's a very, very important insight into meaning, is that finding meaning isn't necessarily just merely finding what feels good and what enjoys in the pleasure sense, but really finding something that makes you accountable to society and to the world, and in our case, to our religion, and that's really where we find meaning. So I'm going to, I figured this was going to happen. I'm going to the last element of finding meaning. He said basically was finding meaning in love, that seeing the true uniqueness of a person is a way to find meaning. So I'm not going to go into those sources now, but you can look at them. I think there's some beautiful ideas. But what I just want to end with, to really tie this all together, is again a pasuk from this week's parsha, that Torah says, "Ki lo lechem levado yichyeh ha'adam, ki al kol motza pi Hashem yichyeh ha'adam." That man does not live on bread alone, but that man may live on anything that the Lord decrees. And I think that sums up this idea of finding meaning very well. That we need basic things for survival, and Frankl would say that was true in the Holocaust also. That they needed their rations of bread and they needed their soup in order to survive. That is definitely true. But the point here is that it's lo alechem levado. That it's not bread alone that makes us that we need, but rather doing Hashem's will, ki al kol motza pi Hashem yichyeh ha'adam, that, you know, that a path for us to find meaning is simply be able to be an Ovid Hashem, to serve God whatever way we can, to find purpose in being attached to the Jewish community, to being part of the Jewish religion. And, you know, of course, again, everybody has their own unique path to meaning, but I believe that some of these ideas that Frankel has here, I think, very much dovetail very well with some Torah ideas. Thank you very much, everyone.